when my girdle is squeezing the life out of me. I also think about fake tanning. It's so cold here 6 months out of the year. When spring comes, everyone wants to look tan. By summer, everyone is bright orange from the tanning beds. That's not very natural. You can't pretend to be natural and confident. I admire the women who say, I'm 50, and this is what I look like. Take it or leave it. Am I describing who I want to be or who others want me to be? Some of both. I want to be confident and natural and want people to describe me that way. I don't care as much about sexy and thin. I want to be healthy, but I think I want to look young and sexy because you are supposed to be those things. I've talked a lot about this with my husband. He doesn't make comments very much anymore. When I talked to him about it, he was shocked about how much it hurt me. My mother-in-law is still pretty judgmental. If someone perceives me as having these unwanted identities, what will happen? At one time I would have said that I'd be embarrassed if I thought people saw me as fat, frumpy, and old. Now I know that it's shame. I guess nothing would happen. I'd just feel made fun of or ridiculed. But truthfully, I don't think anyone would say that about me. Except for me. Can I control how others perceive me? How do I try? Before I learned about shame, I thought I could control how others perceive me. Now I know that no one can. So my answer is cheating a little. I really did believe that you could control perception if you stayed on top of it. Now I know that it's a no-win situation. I don't try as much as I used to. But I still fall back into that thinking. I used to try to control it by not getting myself in situations where I'd be judged. I wouldn't swim at the party, so I could stay in my shorts. But then they're judging you for that. No matter what you do, you can't control how other people see you. As you read Jillian's answers, you can see that reality checking our shame triggers is not easy, and it's almost impossible if we don't have some sense of the big picture. Jillian has certainly zoomed out around her appearance issues in the media. She doesn't just see herself as flawed and incapable of meeting reasonable expectations. She knows what she's up against. It's all women versus a huge beauty industry that's very effective at making us feel bad about ourselves. She seems to have a good sense about how her triggers work and how they affect her. During our second interview, Jillian said, "It's tiring. You can't just know this stuff and think about it once or twice. You have to constantly remind yourself, or you get sucked back in. It's hard, especially when the people around you don't get it." Jillian is right. This element is called practicing critical awareness. If we only ask and answer the questions, we are likely to feel stuck, angry, and overwhelmed. It's bad enough that we are under immense pressure to be unattainably beautiful. But when we learn that this pressure is supported by the weight of multi-billion-dollar industries, we can feel defeated and resigned. Practicing critical awareness means linking our personal experiences to what we learn from the questions and answers. When we do this, we move toward resilience by learning how to contextualize. I see the big picture. Normalize. I'm not the only one. And demystify. I'll share what I know with others. When we fail to make the connections, we increase our shame by individualizing. I am the only one. Pathologizing. Something is wrong with me. And reinforcing. I should be ashamed. I always find examples helpful, especially when I'm trying to get my head around new concepts. So in this chapter, I've also included how Susan, Kayla, Teresa, and Sandra answered their big picture and reality check questions. Understanding the big picture often requires us to investigate issues. For example, the list of beauty facts and statistics earlier in this chapter all came from books or the internet. I really encourage you to do your own detective work. It can be very empowering. Of course, you'll want to make sure that you are pulling information from reputable sources, especially on the internet. But there are many individuals and organizations doing wonderful work on exposing how social community expectations impact the way we think, feel, and act. On my own website, www.brenebrown.com, I have critical awareness resources for all of the shame categories, including exercises, links, and lists of recommended books. During a recent workshop, one woman told the larger group that she's struggled with various shame issues over money. After the workshop, she came up to me and said, "Rather than shopping, I'm going to spend my time investigating how credit card debt hurts women." Right on. Let's look at how Susan, Kayla, Teresa, and Sandra applied the principles of critical awareness to their situations. After Susan answered the big picture and reality check questions, she wrote, "I'm surprised to find myself in this big motherhood war. I didn't think that would happen to me. I'm not a very political person, and I don't really have strong opinions one way or the other when it comes to working or staying at home. I had no idea my decision, which is very personal, to go back to work part-time, would spark such emotion in my sister." She went on to say, "I'm not sure who benefits from all of this pressure. It certainly is not mothers." Susan said, "I had no idea until I wrote it down how much I worry about what other people think. I know I'm a good, committed mom. Why do I care if people see it or not?" In her final thoughts, Susan told me that the most difficult thing for her was letting go of the idea that she could control how people see her, especially her mother and sister. "I just keep working to convince them that this is a good decision for me and our family. I want them to change how they see it. Maybe they will. Maybe they won't. I have no control over it. And that's hard." Kayla read over both sets of critical awareness questions and wrote down one simple but powerful sentence. "I have bought into the messages that are being used to shame me." She explained that she cared what Nancy, her boss, thought and said because she looked up to her and her tough approach about mixing business and family. Kayla said, "No one benefits from this. No one. Everyone has a life outside of work, and that life can be hard. It's not just hard on the women, either. There was a guy whose child was sick, and it got so stressful for him that he had to quit. I felt bad for him when it happened, but not enough to say anything." I asked her if the company benefits by this informal policy, and after thinking for a minute, she said, "No, not really. Everyone is too stressed. That guy who quit to take care of his son was awesome. We needed him, and now he's gone. Maybe people think it's good for the bottom line, but it's not." Kayla told me her next step was to actually consider leaving for another agency. She said, "It might be the same competitive culture everywhere I go, but I could start over with new boundaries and new expectations." Teresa had a difficult time with these questions. She explained, "I just don't know if I'm making excuses for how I feel or doing something that's going to make me feel better. I can't stop thinking that some better, more put-together version of what I have is possible." She said, "One thing is clear. I definitely can't be as stressed and overwhelmed as I am now and have a family that's fun-loving, laid-back, and happy." Even though Teresa and her mother had a distant relationship, she told me that she thinks she sometimes judges her family through her mother's eyes. "My constant disappointment in my life wears on my husband and our marriage. It's hard on my kids. They certainly don't care about it being more perfect. They just want me to be happy. I'm pushing these expectations. My mom is in my head." When Sandra examined how her experience of speaking out fit in the picture in her community, she came across a complicated intersection of race and gender. She said, "On the one hand, Black women are respected for being strong and assertive. This is especially true when we're dealing with white folks. But when it comes to black men, we are supposed to back down. I don't think that Don believes that. But certainly my husband and in-laws don't think I'm showing him enough respect when I challenge his opinions. Sandra went on to say that she believes this takes a toll on black women and girls. She said, I can't be superhuman sometimes and then back down others. I'm really somewhere in the middle. As she used these ideas to reality check her ideal perceptions, she wrote, All of these expectations keep me quiet. If I'm not perfect, I can't speak. I need to be okay with being wrong. I need to be allowed to say, I don't know. I also need to be okay with asserting myself. Sometimes it's as hard to be right as it is to be wrong. In the next sections, we will explore the strategies that move us toward resilience and the common barriers that stand in our way. Contextualizing versus individualizing. The word context is derived from the Latin word contexere, meaning to weave or twine together. When we understand the context of an experience, we see the big picture. It goes back to the zoom lens. When we are in shame, we just see our own struggle. As we zoom out, we start to see others engaged in similar struggles. When we pull completely back, we start to see an even bigger picture. How political, economic, and social forces shape our personal experiences. Contextualizing is the key to making the shame connection. If I understand how industries and individuals benefit from my appearance shame, does that mean the shame goes away? No, unfortunately not. But identifying the contexts in which we feel shame helps us build resilience. If we feel shame because, despite our best efforts, we can't look like the model on the cover of a magazine, it helps to know that the model probably doesn't look like that either. Her blemishes are airbrushed. Her legs are stretched using a computer. Her smile is whitened. And her clothes are borrowed. Magazines make money by selling advertising space, not subscriptions. The goal is to have us look at the woman on the cover, feel bad, and then buy all the lotions and potions advertised in the magazine. If we buy a lot of products, the cosmetic companies buy more advertising space in the magazine, and so on. If we buy into the whole package of what we are supposed to look like and think we can't achieve that look only because we don't have enough willpower or genetic advantage, we sink in shame. Context helps us understand how social community expectations, economics, and politics are all woven together to produce one cohesive image. We can't unravel the truth without recognizing the threads. As the categories indicate, many of us actually fall prey to the same sources of shame, and we experience very similar reactions. However, due to the isolating and secretive nature of shame, we feel like it is only happening to us, and that we must hide it at all costs. This, in turn, has led to our false belief that shame is a personal problem, even a psychological defect of some kind. It's not. Yes, shame can lead to personal problems and even play a role in mental illness, but shame is also a social construct. It happens between people. Shame is how I feel when I see myself through someone else's eyes. I have labeled shame a psychosocial cultural construct. I like to explain it this way. If you stick shame under a psychological microscope, you'll only see part of the picture. If you do the same thing with a social lens or cultural lens, same outcome, you'll only see pieces of the problem. If, however, you combine all three of these lenses, the psychological, social, and cultural, you get the full picture of shame. I think the most dangerous view is looking at shame strictly as a personal problem. When we do that, we see only personal and highly individualized solutions, which leave the layers of competing and conflicting expectations that drive shame intact and unchanged. If one or two, or even 100 women, said they were ashamed of their bodies. That probably wouldn't point to a larger social connection. But it wasn't just a few women. It was more than 90% of the women I interviewed. If it was just Sandra who talked about the fear of experiencing shame when she voiced her opinion or spoke out on public or private issues, then speaking out wouldn't be a shame category. It's a category because a strong pattern emerged across the interviews, indicating that a significant number of women remain quiet rather than deal with their fear of being put down and ridiculed or appearing stupid. The myth of shirking and blaming. Many people mistake contextualizing for a means to shirk our personal responsibilities and blame the system. For example, it's not my fault I can't find a job. It's because I'm a woman. It's not my fault that I can't lose weight. It's the diet industry. It's not my fault that I'm in debt. It's those evil credit card companies. I think contextualizing is the opposite of blaming and shirking. When the women I interviewed talked about the importance of getting the big picture, they didn't talk about making excuses. They talked about finding the power to make changes by understanding the big picture and knowing they weren't the only ones struggling. During my senior year, my mom made me join a group with other girls with trick. At first, I was really pissed. I didn't even believe that other girls had it. In this group, I found out that several million people have it. It didn't make it go away, but at least I know other people. I'm not a total freak. There was even a girl 3 years younger than me, and I was able to help her by telling her how I explained it to my friends. Note, trick is short for trichotillomania, an impulse control disorder that causes people to pull out body hair, skin, head, eyebrows, eyelashes, etc. It seems to occur most frequently in pre- or early adolescent years. I'm one of those people who have a lot of fear about rape. I'm very aware of things like sexual assault, and no means no. I support that, and I believe in it. But I feel a lot of shame because when I think about hot sex, or when I imagine something to make me more excited, or more into sex, those are the kind of fantasies and scenarios I think about in my head. I think about those scenes in the movies when the girl says, "No, no, no," and then it turns into great hot sex. What is that about? How can that be our biggest fear in real life, but also be a big fantasy? I asked my older sister about it, and she said it's because you never see gentle, loving, vulnerable sex in the movies. She said no one would buy tickets. She said people want to see forbidden or fearful sex. And after a while, you start believing that's what it takes to have good sex. I asked her if I was normal, and she said a lot of people buy into that, but no one talks about it because it's shameful. She said the dangerous part is men also believe that women like to be forced. I think you grow up feeling shame about the stuff your parents didn't allow you to talk about when you were little, so anything that a parent makes off-limits, that's the shit that's going to make you crazy when you get older. If you want your kids to be normal, let them talk about everything, and they won't have any shame around it. Then it's just not a big deal anymore. If you grew up with a lot of off-limit things, you have to ask people and figure it all out. The more you know, the more you realize you're not the only one. When we strive to understand the context or the big picture, we don't give up responsibility. We increase it. When we identify a personal struggle that is rooted in larger issues, we should take responsibility for both. Maybe it's not just our job to make things better for ourselves. Maybe we have a responsibility to make things better for our children, our friends, or our community. If we understand how larger systems are contributing to our shame, and we choose only to change ourselves, we become as negligent as the person who says, "I'm not changing myself because the system is bad." Context is not the enemy of personal responsibility. Individualism is the enemy of personal responsibility. A good example of the importance of context and collective action is breast cancer. For many of us, there couldn't be a more personal issue, but however personal it is, we still need the big picture. There have been very important advances in breast cancer research over the past 10 years. These advances could not have happened without advocates who recognized the political, social, and economic contexts of health research. These advocates have pushed breast cancer to the top of the national health agenda, raised millions of dollars, and drastically increased federal funding of breast cancer research. We might be able to make individual choices that lower our risks for breast cancer, but without collective action, we wouldn't know how to manage those risks, and we certainly would not get the level of treatment available today. When we talk about putting issues into context, in order to increase our critical awareness and increase our shame resilience, we need to realize that getting mired in blaming systems is as destructive as being mired in self-blame. When the most effective way to change a situation is to look at the big picture and we individualize the problem, there is little chance that we're going to change it. Normalizing versus pathologizing. When it comes to raising critical awareness and increasing our resilience to shame, the most powerful words we can hear are, "You are not alone." When the research participants talked about critical awareness, the actual words, "You have to find out you're not alone," or "You need to know you're not alone," or "You need to find out you're not the only one," came up verbatim in at least 80% of the interviews. Shame works only if we think we're alone in it. If we think there's someone else, a group of women, a city full of women, a country full of women, a world full of women, struggling with the same issue, the concept of shame becomes bankrupt. However, unless we understand our shame triggers and practice critical awareness, chances are we are not ever going to reach out far enough or often enough for someone to have the opportunity to say, "Hey, you're not alone." On the opposite side of the continuum for normalizing is pathologizing. Pathologizing is classifying something as abnormal or deviant. Without critical awareness, we might believe that the social community expectations are attainable. Individually, it is easy for us to believe that we are the only person who doesn't meet the expectations, therefore there is something abnormal or deviant about us. If we're going to develop and practice critical awareness, we have to be able to normalize experiences to the point of knowing we're not alone. Driving it home with divorce. I talked to many women who spoke about the shame of divorce. Some women spoke about their own divorces, and other women spoke about their parents' divorces. One thread running through many of the experiences was the economic consequence of divorce. For many women, divorce takes a serious financial toll in addition to the emotional toll. Here are four examples. I went from being the perfect mom and the perfect wife to broke, unemployed, and alone. No one calls you poor when you're married and staying at home with your kids. Not even when all the money really belongs to your husband. You think his money is our money, and so on. Then one day he leaves and takes everything with him, except the kids, thank God. I didn't even know where to mail the mortgage. Now my kids and I live at home with my parents. When you're in your 20s and you move back in with your parents, people think you're lost and trying to find your way. When you're 40 and move back in, everyone thinks you're pathetic. The truth is, we're just lost and trying to find our way. People tell you not to feel shame for your parents' divorce. That's easier said than done. Try telling your son that his grandparents aren't coming to his bar mitzvah because they can't stand to be in the same place. Who feels that shame? What about begging your father for money so you can fill your mother's prescriptions? My father always tells me, "You're on her side. He just won't understand. He left her with nothing. I'm not on anyone's side, but of course I'm going to care for my mother." My parents divorced when I was 10. I've spent the last 8 years listening to my mom tell me horrible stories about my father. She's constantly saying, "If he loved you, he'd do more for you. He left her in pretty bad shape. But he was also broke. If she had more money, she'd probably get off his back. I love my father. He's a good, decent person, and a good dad. She makes me feel ashamed to love him. Ironically, he's the one that makes me feel better about my mom. He never says anything bad about her. He actually defends her sometimes. It's so confusing. I knew we needed to get divorced. He had several affairs, and our fights were starting to affect our children. I had this idea in my head that I could start over, make a new life. I thought I could get a small, cute house, a part-time job, and we'd be okay. 6 months after we sold our house, I was $14,000 in debt. I had a job that paid $6 per hour, and I could barely make rent. Rather than helping, my ex-husband suggested he take the kids until I got back on my feet. I was so ashamed that I couldn't take care of my own children. I should have known better than to ever let that happen. I got a second job, but that leaves me no time to be at home with the boys. They still live with him. Like most women, when I read these stories, I feel some combination of sadness, fear, and a need to protect myself from acknowledging that this could ever happen to me. When we do that, however, we reinforce the stereotypes of women who struggle financially after divorce by individualizing their situations. She brought that on herself. That's a personal problem, not a community problem. And in many ways, we make women out to be flawed, damaged, or somehow abnormal. It's stupid not to know about the family finances. She'd look harder if she really wanted a good job. If we want to develop critical awareness, we start by acknowledging the importance of context. Once we have a better understanding of the big picture, we start linking. What political, social, and economic realities do divorced women face? Here's what we know. Researchers consistently find that women suffer significant economic losses after divorce, much more than their male ex-partners. Researchers agree that a woman's post-divorce income is driven by labor force participation. Women who work, especially those who have an education and can secure high-income jobs, do better after a divorce. Women who have not worked during their marriage face larger economic obstacles. 90% of children stay with their mothers. Only 1 in 4 divorced mothers does not have a court-ordered child support award. Among divorced mothers who have a support award, 50% receive the full amount, 25% receive only a part, and 25% receive nothing. Divorced parents, both men and women, are more likely to pay child support if they have an ongoing relationship with their children. Research also shows that the ability for women to financially recover after divorce has increased over the past few years. When we talk to women in my mother's generation, it is easy to understand why many of them suffered great personal and financial losses when they divorced. They didn't participate in the workforce as much as women do today. When they did work, it was often in traditional support or service jobs. If they had high-status jobs, they were paid much less than men, and there were no child support laws. As we strive to understand issues in their social, political, and economic contexts, we are better able to move away from individualizing problems and making them about someone's character flaw. We also become less likely to pathologize women and more likely to understand how and why things work. When we tear down the myths of divorce and really examine the realities and contexts, we build a new understanding that makes us far more critically aware and far less likely to blame women, including ourselves. Critical awareness also requires us to question this notion of blaming the victim. In particular, some pop psychologists preach that there is no such thing as reality, just perception. Not only is this inaccurate, it's dangerous. Racism is real. Domestic violence is real. Homophobia is real. The economics of divorce are real. When you tell people their situation is only perception and they can change it, you shame them, belittle them, and in the case of domestic violence, you put them in extreme physical danger. Rather than dismissing someone's experience as perception, we might want to ask, how can I help? Or is there some way I can support you? It might be accurate to say that we all see things differently, but the world trades in both reality and perception. Try paying your mortgage with paper you perceive as money. Or try walking out of the store with that Kate Spade bag and telling the police, it matches my shoes, so I perceive it's mine. Demystifying versus reinforcing. The last benefit of practicing critical awareness is demystifying. If we want to demystify something, we simply break it down and take the mystery out of it. How many times do we see something unusual or interesting and, even if we are dying to know about it, feel too unworthy to ask what it is, how much it costs, or how it works? If we start demystifying by asking the critical awareness questions, we often find that the answers are kept secret for a reason. When individuals, groups, or institutions want to exclude people or raise their status, they have a tendency to shroud themselves, their products, or their ideas in mystery. One example from my life is the mysterious power of getting a PhD. Every semester, without fail, I have female students come to my door and with their heads hung low say, I think I might be interested in getting my doctorate, and I don't know that I can really do it, but I'm wondering if you're not too busy, if you could tell me about your experiences or how it works. Well, I love getting that question because for me, part of building critical awareness is not only seeking to demystify issues for myself, but helping other people do it too. I firmly believe that if we have mysterious powers, if we know how something sacred works, we are obligated to share what we know. Knowledge is power, and power is never diminished by sharing it. It is only increased. My degree doesn't lose value if I help other women figure out how to get into graduate school. I love peeling the layers of mystery off that process. The opposite of demystifying is reinforcing. Reinforcing is protecting the mystery of something so we can feel more important and secure. I think we are most susceptible to reinforcing when we feel shame about an issue. But when we reinforce, we weave webs that not only entangle other women, but eventually trap us. Here are two sample responses to the questions women ask me about applying to graduate school. That's exciting. I'm glad you asked. I was really nervous about applying, but a couple of people gave me some good pointers. I'm happy to share what I know. Well, we can talk about the fit between this program and your epistemological interests because it's very important to develop a strong program of inquiry before you start applying. You want to make sure, methodologically, that your research agenda is compatible with the research agenda of the college and the scholars with whom you will do your training. These are actual responses that I received when I asked for help with my graduate application. After that second response, what saved me from shame and yielding to intimidation was my level of acknowledged vulnerability. When I reached out, I knew I was vulnerable. I knew being perceived as not smart enough was a major trigger for me. The research participants frequently discussed the important relationship between understanding their shame triggers, demystifying, and reinforcing. When we don't understand something, and not understanding is a shame trigger, we are often too fearful to even ask for an explanation. I've named this the edamame threat. The edamame threat, it's more than a soybean. The word edamame means beans on branches. Edamame is a green vegetable soybean that is incorporated into many types of dishes and often eaten as a snack. A couple of years ago, Steve and I went to a dinner party at an acquaintance's house. These were new, fancy friends, and I was anxious to make a good impression. When we got there, they offered us an appetizer, a big silver bowl of beans. When I first saw them, I thought they were beans that needed to be shucked for dinner, so when they offered them to us as an appetizer, I'm sure I looked shocked. I said, "Really, what is it?" I'll never forget the look on their faces. They were absolutely floored. "What do you mean, what is it?" I immediately felt a warm wave of shame. I apologetically asked, "Are they beans?" The host replied, "Of course, it's edamame. Don't tell me you've never had edamame. Don't you eat sushi?" Then, as if it were both unbelievable and fascinating, she started turning to other dinner guests and announcing, "They've never had edamame. Can you believe it?" I desperately wanted to turn right around and go home. I was filled with shame. A couple of weeks later, I was in my office and eating some beans. I ended up really loving edamame. A student knocked on the door and asked if she could come in to talk to me about a paper. I'm not sure why this student pushed my buttons, but she did. It was probably because she reminded me of myself when I was in my late 20s, smart but at times painfully insecure and trying harder than necessary. She looked at my bag of beans and said, "What are those?" In that split second, I felt the dinner party shame all over again. In what must have been an attempt to shift shame by putting some of my shame onto her, I said, "Edamame, of course. Haven't you had them?" She looked embarrassed. "No, I don't think so. Are they good?" And then, in a very Joan Crawford way, I said, "I can't believe you haven't tried them. They're the superfood. They are fabulous." By the time she left my office, I was numb. I couldn't believe it. Why had I done that? Why did I care so much? I'm not a food snob. I have no stake in soybeans. I thought about it for several days before it hit me. I didn't feel shame because I had never tried edamame. I didn't reinforce because it was important for me to feel smarter than the student. I felt shame because for me, not knowing about Japanese food was a class and culture issue. The people at the dinner party were real food elitists. They were the kind of people who travel the world and know all about art and wine. Their toddlers eat food I can't even pronounce. The more I thought about it, the more I realized that class was a major shame trigger for me. That's hard for people to understand at times because I'm a college professor, and my husband is a pediatrician. Our professional peers frequently assume that we share their background, but often we don't. When I was in my 20s, I was not eating sushi and studying at Harvard to fulfill my legacy to become an academic. I worked for the phone company, and I was a member of the same local union hall that my parents belonged to when they were in their 20s. My parents worked hard to expose us to different cultures, music, books, and food, but we were certainly not exposed at the same level as the fancy friends. A few months after the reinforcing incident, Dawn came to Houston for a visit. When it comes to demystifying class issues, she's my go-to girl. When I'm with her, I can ask anything, or safely share anything. We came from the same place, and we have ended up in the same place. As I started fixing our lunch, I said, "Hey, I'm going to make some edamame. Have you tried it before?" She looked at me and said, "No, but I've heard of it. What is it?" I smiled. "I think it's the Japanese word for soybeans. You boil them, sprinkle them with salt, pop the seeds out and eat them. They're really good. I just had them for the first time a few months ago." Demystifying is a choice. If you know something, and you have the opportunity to demystify it or reinforce it, you have the opportunity to move along on the shame resilience continuum. When we choose to reinforce, we should ask ourselves why we feel better keeping what we know a mystery. I've told this story in my talks and seminars many times, and I can't tell you how many emails and letters I've received about it. Some of them are just about the general concept of demystifying. But strangely enough, many of the letters are specifically about edamame. One young woman wrote in an email, "I had never had edamame before, and though I'd seen it on menus, I never wanted to order it because I didn't know how to pronounce it. After reading your story, I laughed, asked a good friend who wouldn't judge me to order some when we were eating sushi, and asked her to show me how to eat them. I love the dish now, and I think of you every time I have it. Having come from a very poor Mexican immigrant background, I really related to your story. Demystifying credentials. During the interviews, many women associated shame with educators and helping professionals. As an educator, I was not at all surprised to hear shame identified as an issue in the classroom. In fact, I believe that shame is one of the greatest barriers to learning. I'm afraid the social community pressure to appear learned has become more important than actually learning. When we spend our time and energy building and protecting our image of knowing, it is highly unlikely that we will risk admitting we don't understand or asking questions, both of which are essential to real knowledge building. I was, however, shocked to learn that the mere concept of credentials evoked shame in women. Women talked about shame preventing them from returning to school, going to psychotherapy, going to the doctor, visiting the dentist, and even talking to members of the clergy. In this section, I want to share my observations on credentials and how we often turn our power over at the first glance of initials strung behind someone's name. Folks with credentials have three distinct advantages over the folks they are working with. One, they have permission to not know. Two, they have permission to not tell. And three, their objectivity is not questioned. When most people are asked a question or put on the spot for information, they feel tremendous pressure to come up with an answer, preferably the right one. If we can't produce an answer, or we supply the wrong information, we often feel judged. If we are credentialed, however, we automatically have the right not to know, or the right not to answer. Credentials can be excellent get-out-of-jail-free cards. For example, in my bachelor's program, an incorrect answer or no answer reflected my lack of preparation or my lack of knowledge. Most of the time I felt embarrassed, but occasionally I felt shame. But in my master's program, I could reply to questions with a simple, "I really don't know." It wasn't the best answer, but more times than not, I was validated for answering honestly. At the doctoral level, if someone asked me a question that I couldn't answer, they'd either assume they had asked a bad question, or that I was too smart or busy to concern myself with such foolish matters. One of the perks of earning credentials is gaining permission to know nothing. This privilege is rarely afforded to those who aren't protected by plaques, titles, certificates, or initials strung behind their names. The second advantage is what I call the do-ask-don't-tell policy. In all fields where credentials are issued, elusiveness is either formally taught or, at the very least, informally modeled. Most educators and helping professionals, therapists, physicians, social workers, clergy, etc., have been trained to extract information from reluctant consumers while sharing as little as possible about their lives. The unspoken rule states the greater the credentials and status, the more you're allowed to know about others, and the less you have to reveal about yourself. Think about it. Your doctor may know your sexual history, your weight, and how many bowel movements you have per week, yet it's questionable for you to ask if she's married or has children. Many professionals will quip back, "We aren't talking about me," or "That's not relevant." Here are four examples. When I got pregnant, rather than going to the doctor and getting prenatal care, I waited until I was 6 months pregnant. I waited until it was too late for me not to be pregnant anymore. I was so afraid the doctor was going to say, "You're too fat to have a baby, you shouldn't be pregnant." It scared me, and I was so ashamed that I just waited and waited. I can't believe I put myself or my baby at risk because I was so humiliated about my weight. I just hate doctors. My daughter died of cancer when she was 6. My preacher said that I was being selfish by grieving her death because she was in a better place. She was with God. He is a very smart and educated man, but I think what he said was cruel. It made me hate him. It made me hate my church, and it made me hate God. I still hate the preacher. I still don't go to church, and I'm working on things with God. But how dare someone shame you about grieving the death of your own child? No collar, no degree should allow you to do that. Do you have any idea how many years it took me to get over the shame of being sad? I'm allowed to grieve. A part of me will always grieve. What he said was a terrible, terrible injustice. He took advantage of his position. The very first time my son got an ear infection, my pediatrician said, "Well, what's it going to be? Your career or your son's hearing?" Only a doctor would feel entitled to say something like that. I asked him if his kids went to daycare, and he said, "My kids aren't in the doctor's office with an ear infection." You resent them for acting so much better than everyone else, yet you totally depend on them. I was 58 when I went back to graduate school. I didn't even know how to email or use the computer. The last time I was in school, we thought erasable bond was revolutionary. I knew it would be intimidating, but when I'm in class, I turn into a bumbling idiot. If I want to ask a question or make a point, I trip all over myself. Not because of the other students, but because of these young professors. They make me so nervous. A few of them are younger than my kids. I hate feeling foolish in front of them. The third advantage of the credentialed is the assumption of objectivity. Most credentialed professionals do indeed receive some type of training regarding objectivity, but there is ongoing debate about what is truly achievable. Some are taught that objectivity is possible, and they are trained to try to replace their personal lenses with professional lenses when they are with clients or patients. Others, including me, are taught that pure objectivity does not exist and that people can't ever completely put away their personal lenses. We are trained instead to understand the biases and power of our experiences so we understand how they might affect our interactions with clients. We believe this is the most ethical way to work with clients. In my experience, the most serious threat to objectivity is the very belief that pure objectivity and value neutrality exist. I have greater trust in those who question objectivity and who believe that people, values, and experiences influence our research and practice. They are the ones who make the greatest effort to present their opinions in the appropriate context. When we interview doctors, therapists, and other credentialed professionals, we can't assume objectivity. We don't have the right to infringe on their private lives, but we do have the right to understand their professional values, ethics, and their motivation for working with us. This is especially true for professionals who offer advice or guidance. I went to a pediatrician who supports mothers in the workforce. I went to an OBGYN who shares some of my basic beliefs about pregnancy and childbirth. I want a CPA who understands my values and ethics. And I certainly want a therapist who shares my basic values about how people change. Given the power of credentials, it is easy to understand why shame often results from interactions with the credentialed. To build connection and power in these situations, we need to practice our critical awareness skills. We need to determine who benefits from our fear and shame and decide how we can find support. Toward that end, we should not hesitate to get referrals from friends. And we must also accept that we have an absolute right to interview credentialed professionals about how they practice before we expose our most personal information or vulnerabilities. In the next chapter, we will learn about the power of reaching out. While the four shame resilience elements don't always happen in a particular order, I have found that understanding our triggers and having some level of critical awareness about our issues make reaching out to others less scary. This is important because, as the next chapter will demonstrate, reaching out is the single most powerful act of resilience. 5. The third element, reaching out. I'd like to start this chapter by sharing three letters I received from women who have been applying the concepts in this book to their own lives. The first woman, Letitia, emailed this experience to me. One afternoon, I was on the phone with my mother, telling her about a guy who wanted a relationship with me, but in whom I was not really interested. My mother was still in favor of him, and in explaining why, she said, "He likes you, even though you aren't skinny. It doesn't matter to him that you are heavy. He still thinks you are pretty." On the other end of the line, my jaw dropped. A few years ago, I'd undergone treatment for an eating disorder. I was seeing up to 4 doctors at a time for it. My mom is well aware of my medical history. The first thing that came through my mind was, wow, a few years ago, that would totally have thrown me into despair. I would have hung up with her and then cried with shame over my size and felt that no one could ever really love me with this body and that I had to be grateful for anyone who did. Having read about shame, though, I realized that both my mother and my weight were triggers for me, and I was able to step back from the situation and see my mother's comment as her poorly executed attempt at support, rather than react in anger, as I would have in the past. It still shook me a little and bothered me that her attitude was so negative, but I had awareness of the situation and was able to call a good friend to discuss the situation and diffuse the emotional buildup. It also gave me better insight to where so many of my body issues came from. This second piece is a longer letter about putting the elements of shame resilience to work. Dr. Brown, I have been affected by your work in 2 areas. One, I learned to identify what I was feeling as shame, and second, I learned how to act on it by speaking shame. I learned that I am very shame-based, that I had all of the symptoms of shame that you speak of, but never really related them to the concept of shame. It's kind of like having a lot of strange and disparate symptoms, but not knowing what to attribute them to. If you don't know what the disease is, you can't treat it. When painful things happened, my face would flush, my stomach would tighten, and I would want to hide. But since the situations were all different, even though my reaction might be the same, I never could specifically identify the emotion I was feeling. So I never really could deal with it. Plus, I was so busy trying my old methods of coping, that is, trying to develop amnesia about the events, that I didn't spend much time trying to figure out what was going on and how to deal with it more effectively. In fact, I was so disassociated from the concept of shame that I wasn't sure that it even applied to me. Somehow, shame was for other people. Only through reading your work was I able to see how pervasive shame was in my life and how ineffective I had been at both identifying it and dealing with it. My favorite part of shame resilience theory is speaking shame. For me, that means identifying shame and then dealing with it in more appropriate ways. I now can more effectively identify those situations in which I feel shame. It is usually prompted by a strong physiological reaction such as face flushes, stomach tightens, and I replay the incident over and over in my head while actively trying to forget it ever happened. This strategy doesn't work well, and years later, the recall of a shameful incident will cause me to wince and flush. But now I am able to catch myself and label this reaction shame. So now I have a name for it and some effective action that I can take. My most effective action now is finding someone supportive to tell my shame story to instead of holding it in. I love the metaphor of the petri dish. For when I kept my shame silent and in the dark, it grew exponentially. However, exposing it to the light of day causes it to lose its power and even shrink. Now, instead of cringing, I can almost laugh at some of my experiences. Sometimes I am even eager to tell my shame story to others. Other times, I more reluctantly share my stories. For example, one day I had a group of old neighbors over to my new home. I had always felt insecure around these old neighborhood friends, as they were the type of women that dressed really lovely and decorated their homes to perfection. I was friendly with this group, but always felt a little on the outside, as I cared less about clothes and home decor. In turn, they seemed to view me with paternalistic bemusement. Poor bumbling Barbara. I always felt less than in their presence. Well, I had moved to a new home, and had spent a lot of time decorating it, and was very proud of my more sophisticated taste, so I invited them over, along with other old friends from the neighborhood. I was so eager to please and impress that I went really overboard on the food, and my large dining table nearly groaned with platter after platter piled high with wonderful cheeses, chips, and dips, and desserts. However, the party was not well attended, except for this one group of women that I was so desperate to impress, so they came and loved the house, and we caught up on our lives. And then there was this table covered with food, and they ate only a few bites. Did I mention they were all thin, too? After they left, I was mortified. Up into that point, I had not realized how hard I was trying to impress them and make up for my perceived past poor showing by inviting them to my new place. And now, instead of rectifying the past shame, I created more shame by having this table full of food that was untouched. The heaping trays of food represented my shame to me, and it was piled high and deep. I saw myself as looking foolish and trying so hard to impress this group of women, and I had failed yet again. In the past, I would have tried to hide the shame and maybe thrown out the food as a way to hide my shame. However, with my new skills, I reached out to a friend who I could trust to understand and share my pain. I called her and told her the story and cried. And she came over the next day, and we ate the leftovers for lunch. After talking seriously about the issues, I was even able to laugh about my attempts to garner approval and joked about the food, and I felt better. Having it all out in the open, I could more clearly see that I was looking for approval in the wrong places from the wrong people. I could let go of the shame. Today, when I think of the experience, I generally smile rather than wince. I think of my friend and I, sitting at the table and laughing and eating the food rather than the botched party. This was a real change for me, for in the past, I would have stuffed down the shame instead of the food. My husband had an opportunity to hear an abbreviated version of your shame presentation, and that has been helpful as well. We talk shame together and use it to better our communication as a couple. I also think learning about shame has made me a more empathetic person. I have always prided myself on listening to and not judging others. However, knowing about shame has taken that to new levels. I realize what is at stake when someone chooses to share their shameful stories with me, and I know the damage that can be done by greeting such a story with judgment instead of empathy. So I am more aware of trying to comfort that person and let them know that all of us end up in the shame soup at times, that I might be the person on shore throwing the life vest this time, but next time I will be in the shame soup and need some help myself. I am so much more aware that that distancing from others and using us and them strategies separates people and instills a false sense of superiority. So I am much more aware of my shame and the shame of others, and really work to develop compassion for us all. This is an email from a therapist who uses the work with her clients and in her personal life. Dear Brené, as a counselor for survivors of domestic and sexual violence, dealing with shame has always been a difficult part of my work. Your work has been a great tool for working with my clients. I use the activities in my groups and with my individual clients. I think the most helpful part of this book for me has been that I'm now able to identify shame and how it is affecting my clients more frequently. I have the tools of helping them acknowledge personal vulnerability using critical awareness and facilitating their ability to speak shame. It's almost like magic. Being able to dissolve shame and move forward is a powerful part of healing. In my personal life, I have used your work as well. I talk about shame.